Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
The difference between George W. Bush and Donald Trump isn't that George W. Bush was willing to go to war and Donald Trump wasn't, but that Donald Trump will say things like, we're going to destroy all of Iranian civilization. And George W. Bush would say, like, we're going to bring democracy to Afghanistan.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jerusalem Demsis.
I'm Matthew Iglesias.
And this is The Argument. This week, tomorrow is the 25th anniversary of 9/11. And Matt and I want to talk about it. Matt, what was your argument this week?
So my 9/11 was bad. I think obviously everybody knows that this was a big deal. It's why we commemorate its anniversary. 25 is a nice big round number. But I think that this is an event that like really changed the trajectory of world history in a way that, you know, was not just baked into the fundamentals of it, but that the specifics and the contingencies of the moment and the very early response decisions put us on a whole new course that I think is not the course Osama bin Laden wanted, but also is not a course that has ended up that well for the world.
So I was 6 years old when 9/11 happened. I don't remember it. Mm-hmm. I feel like I really only learned about it in high school. And then also, as I decided to look into it for this episode, learned a lot of facts that I was unaware of. But what is your take that it was underrated?
Well, I mean, you know, you're talking about facts. And I think that this is important. You know, I remember I would just, I was in college and it was kind of like the day before we were supposed to register for classes and college students sleep.
Were you a freshman?
No, okay. Sophomore year. And I was always an early riser, even like when people weren't. And I like walked and I went to the cafeteria and I was having some breakfast.
Yeah.
And like somebody else there, like the jocks who were up early was like, oh my God, like planes flew into the World Trade Center. And I thought, huh, it didn't make that much of an impression on me.
Wow.
And I was like heading back and I saw somebody who I knew a little bit from New York, just like sobbing on the street. And I was like, what's going on? And she's like reacting very, she's telling me the same thing that somebody already told me, but like with like emotion.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh. And then I got back to my room and I looked on the computer and I was like, oh shit, like this is a big deal. I better try to
Were you able to watch the video on your computer at the time?
Or is that no, I said I better get in touch with my parents.
Yeah.
And so I tried to call them and I couldn't.
Yeah.
Because the phone circuits in New York were all jammed. And then I went down to like a common room somewhere where there was TV. And like we were watching it. And, you know, it's both.
Did you watch the towers come down?
Yeah. So a lot of people died and a huge share of the population watched it live on television. And it had an incredibly strong emotional impact that I think then and now has sort of like blocked out some of the specificity of like what occurred and how sort of like not obvious it was. As it happens, as it goes down, it's like people are saying, like, is this terrorism? And like, clearly, if it is,
Because you thought it was an accident at first. You're like, when the first plane,
Yeah, I mean, one plane hits a building, you think it's an accident.
Yeah.
Right? Two, problem.
Yeah.
Clearly, like, something was going to happen. Like, it was a big deal. But, you know, like, the Bush administration chose very early on to sort of, like, define what it was that had happened in a way that I think was like non-obvious. And they had some good reasons, I think, behind the choices that they made, but it really didn't turn out well. And also just like the plot itself, you know, there was some people tried to blow up the World Trade Center in 1994 and it didn't really work. And like a half dozen people died.
Six people and one unborn child.
Okay. And so, I mean, I remember that too. Like I was doing a tennis lesson in New York when that happened. And it like, when I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But then because it was only six people, I mean, this is the early 90s. People were getting murdered in New York all the time.
Yeah.
And there just like wasn't a huge.
Like thousands, like, I don't know, thousands were injured. Like it wasn't like nothing. It was like,
I mean, but like that's what I'm saying, that like a terrorist attack that killed people and that injured many people and they clearly like could have taken down, had that worked, I believe the death toll would have been higher than actual 9/11 because the building was more crowded. But The fact that fewer people died meant that the emotional response was much more muted. And the policy response to that was like a shift in the trajectory of American policy towards Sudan and Afghanistan, mm-hmm. but not like a revolution.
For people, whether you were alive or not alive, or you remember it, but you kind of have hazy details. There's some study about it. People who say they remember 9/11 often get a lot of the details actually wrong because it was obviously an incredibly emotional moment, as you were saying. 2,977 people die on 9/11. It's 19 men who are working for Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is like a transnational terrorist organization that comes out of the anti-Soviet jihad. And as Matt was saying, like the World Trade Center bombing, it's not just that like it was also a bombing in New York City. It's like the same guy who was the mastermind of 9/11 was like heavily involved in the World Trade Center bombing. He's referred to as KSM. His full name is Khalid
Sheikh Mohammed.
Sheikh Mohammed. Yeah. In 1996, KSM suggests to Osama bin Laden, hey, like we should consider using planes to go after the World Trade Center again. A couple years later, Osama bin Laden's like approved some version of this plan. And then, you know, it's kind of remarkable. I think in total, when I was reading the 9/11 commission report of this, it caused like roughly $400,000 to $500,000,
yeah,
for this entire thing to happen. Like, all, most of these men come into the United States on visas. Some of them obviously lie on their visa applications, but they come into the United States on visas. They are living in and around the United States for a good amount of time before the attack actually happens. And it's actually an incredibly, I mean, this sounds callous, but it's like a very efficient enterprise, right? Like, it's not like a very complicated thing they do. They get on a bunch of planes. As a result of this, of course, they harden the cockpit doors. But before then, like, it was much easier to break into the cockpit and take control of the planes. You have two planes, of course, fly into the Twin Towers in New York. And over the course of, like, over 100 minutes, both towers collapse. I think that's one thing that's like, I feel like I didn't watch it live. I only think I saw the footage for the first time when I was in high school. But I think it's like super underrated, like how long it took for that to happen after the planes had hit it, which makes sense because like the planes hit the building. It like weakens a bunch of the supports. A bunch of fires kind of go off, which also the heat makes the floors sag and then also is difficult for the supports. And then all of that leads to a collapse of not just one, but second one. So like people are like riveted to their TV screens, and I'm like, obviously, like from reading this, I don't know.
Yes, yes. But like, no, but people, I mean, this is the point of my story.
Like, it takes 100 minutes for like the second one to go down, and so like people are just like, the whole world is like kind of stopped, just like watching TV. And I don't think people thought it was going to go down when it first gets hit, and because that was the original intent. And I think that like connecting it again to the World Trade Center bombing, like the goal has been since the WTC bombing, at least, to bring down these specific towers.
And I know, you know, human memory is like super duper fallible.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say that this is what I remember thinking 25 years ago, but maybe I'm duping myself.
Yeah.
But my recollection is that I was watching it and I was thinking, well, they hit the building way too high. Right?
The
it's not falling down.
Yeah.
Like we can see there's a fire burning.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you look at the video, the collision is high, yeah, up on the tower. And I don't know anything about engineering, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a know-it-all. But it's like, well, if you'd like zoom down,
yeah,
this would be so much worse.
Mm-hmm.
And the towers would be falling down. But like, it's probably okay.
Yeah.
And then, you know, clearly it was not.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, there was just, you know,
but it's also like remarkable. I mean, like obviously because it took so long, a lot of people were able to evacuate and get out of the building, which is good. But like, I don't know, 3,000 people. I mean, it's a lot. I mean,
also one of the casualties were very heavily. A lot of police and firefighters,
yes,
died,
yeah,
rather than office building workers. Because again, the long time meant it saved lives on net,
yeah,
because they were able to do evacuation. But it meant that first responders were killed, yeah, rather than if the buildings had like instantaneously vaporized or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's office workers. But, and you know, all human lives are like beautiful and equal, but you know, there's a certain specific resonance to the firefighters and police officers who came in to help others and ended up sacrificing their lives and their families. I have tried over the past 25 years to become a rational person who says things like, you know, it doesn't matter, like objectively, whether you watched these people die on television or just heard that they died overnight, you know, which is true, right? Yeah. But part of that is because I know vividly that so much of the response in practice was because the emotional impact does matter.
Yeah.
Like a guy tries to blow up a building that would have killed thousands of people if he had like located it a little bit differently, provokes a totally different response from the building actually falls down and the people actually do die. Different amounts of people sobbing, different amounts of panic. And it's a different world. And also, I mean, you see this very clearly in the 9/11 Commission report, but it's not like this was such a great plot. That like there's no way it could have been unraveled.
No, I think that's part of, I mean, like every time you read about almost any major event in US history or in world history, whatever, the contingencies are really shocking. Reading the 9/11 Commission report, seeing all the contingencies that came in advance. I mean, some of the more like absurd ones are, there was a guy who was getting flight training in Minnesota. And he seemed suspiciously uninterested in both taking off and landing of planes. And he gets detained for a routine, like, immigration violation. And he's actually detained through 9/11 itself. And, like, people, and there's, like, reports that, like, you know, they wanted to search his laptop and they wanted to like do more intensive searching, but there's like, you know, there's some, they don't have like the probable cause they need. And they're like, we're just going to deport him. He's supposed to be deported to France, which is where I guess he came into the country from. And like, I don't know what was on his laptop. We don't know that. I don't think, at least it wasn't in the report, but there were many things like that where it's like, okay, well, we could have had this information. There's, of course, the famous presidential briefing where it says like Osama bin Laden is going to be targeting the United States. And it's just like, there's a sense of this was unthinkable that clearly pervaded the like post 9/11 moment. But like, clearly, like many people actually were thinking about the potential for people to use planes to hijack them and to, you know, attack the United States.
Well, so you were referring to the Zacharias Moussaoui case. So, you know, he had been flagged as suspicious by a flight instructor, was picked up on immigration charges, was in detention. They applied for a warrant and it was like ruled that it didn't meet the FISA criteria.
Yeah.
But there's a different guy who was in custody from the World Trade Center plot. And after 9/11, they show this guy Moussaoui's photo and like, do you know this guy? And they're like, he says like, yes, that's Zacharias Moussaoui. Like we trained together in Al-Qaeda camp. And so if they had asked the guy, you know, they like had this Al-Qaeda source in custody and they had another guy who the FBI in Minnesota like thought was doing terrorism.
Yeah.
But they didn't like get the,
I don't want to like make it sound like these people should have figured it out.
No. Just to say that like the point of the 9/11 Commission report came out years after the event.
Yeah.
And it paints a narrative, which is like there's a bunch of these failure points. There's this guy, Khalid al-Mindhar. And the CIA tries to keep track of dangerous terrorists, and they observed him in Malaysia going to a like some kind of Al-Qaeda summit with a guy who was involved in the bombing of the USS Cole, which was a naval ship. And so they like wrote down in their, you know, intelligence notebook, like this guy is an Al-Qaeda operative. He then like applied for a visa to come to the United States, got the visa, came to the United States, was here for a while, left the United States, went to Yemen, went to Afghanistan, and then came back to the United States. And then he was hijacking one of the planes. So again, you know, the 9/11 Commission report, like it raises the question of maybe if the CIA decides you're a terrorist, that should go to the INS so that they don't give you the visa, right?
Like, these things were just not integrated. Like, there were individual agencies that were aware of certain concerning pieces of information, and they were not. And like, there was some one of the points the commission report makes is like, it was like it had to go to the president level in order to like resolve a lot of these interagency issues.
And so, you know, this was like understood at the time, and the Patriot Act passed and was supposed to address some of these things. And after the World Trade Center bombings in 1994, politics was different back then. But, you know, the Clinton administration was like really, really tough on crime.
Yeah.
And Republicans were more civil libertarian back then. And because of the Oklahoma City bombing and the World Trade Center bombing, they put forward like a suite of like counterterrorism surveillance proposals that Republicans mostly opposed.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that happened on 9/11 was like Republicans flipped on that and the Patriot Act happened. But in part because it took a while to like compile this information, like go back through the files, the discourse, you know, 1 hour, 1 day, 1 week, 1 month after the attacks wasn't like, we need to improve our procedures for like identifying and catching.
No, it's like September 20th when Bush does his address. He says, it begins with Al-Qaeda, but it doesn't end there. And I'm like, I don't know. Again, my perspective on this is a bit like different because I mean, not just because I was young, but because like my parents grew up in the middle of a conflict that was in no small part blamed on the United States for intervening in the Ethiopian-Eritrean civil war. And so like from their perspective, they're like, yeah, Bush's father wanted to go after Saddam Hussein. This is the Gulf War. And like Bush is now having an opportunity to finally do what his dad was unable to do, which is to kill Saddam Hussein. And like, I was a child. I don't remember when this happened. I don't remember the kind of whatever. But I remember my parents saying this to me and talking about this a lot. But like, it is remarkable in hindsight to go like 9 days after a terrorist organization has killed 3,000 people in the United States. Terrorist organization, Al-Qaeda. There is like no evidence at this point that Al-Qaeda and that Saddam Hussein was involved in this plot. We know now the best evidence that he like was not involved in the plot on 9/11. But like, it's clear that like the hope, not, I don't want to say hope, I don't want to put it in like a, you know, they were happy about it, but they're like, there is a view that this is a moment to take advantage of this emergency to do a broader intervention than merely responding to like, there's a terrorist attack, we need to of course make sure this never happens again, and then we need to find the specific people who perpetrated it and either like capture or kill them. Like, that is like clearly not the goal 9 days after.
Well,
the
and that's why I think, you know, contingency is important here on a number of levels, right? Because again, imagine that this plot had been unraveled, right? That like, say they get this guy's laptop and the laptop, who knows? Say even just the laptop like specifies the thing about like, well, we can use box cutters as weapons to hijack a plane. So then like an emergency order goes out across the TSA that like we're going to, you know, the only policy change, right?
Is to strengthen
the cockpit doors and change the rules about what you're allowed to bring on a plane. And then these guys, because they're like fairly seasoned operatives, have to like call it off because it's not going to work. Now, that doesn't mean that like Al-Qaeda goes away or that
they probably try again. Clearly they've been trying forever. Right. Yeah.
But so, you know, because there's a view, I mean, there's always been this discourse around like 9/11 and how much we should like understand it as like blowback to other American. But so all that stuff would like just still be in motion.
Yeah.
But very possibly they would just never have been able to pull off something quite as spectacular as that. You come up with something else.
I mean, other things they were suggesting were like, they were thinking about going after targets in Israel. They were thinking about, you know, more other non-American targets in American-aligned countries. Going after, I mean, I remember there was one comment about like trying to go after like Jewish targets in New York City.
Right.
So like things like that would have been obviously terrible, but just not as, I mean, I think the visuals are really hard. I think the first time I really got a sense of the visuals is like when I went to the 9/11 Memorial. And with the 9/11 Memorial, and this is now a like cold take, insanely bad choice to like make them like a convex, like wound in the, like in the middle of New York City. It's like, I don't know. I feel like they should have just rebuilt the tower. I don't know. That's my take.
All right.
This is a cult take.
I'm going to leave that alone. But I
think like the visuals of it were like incredibly important. That's why they kept going back to the same place. Yeah.
And I just, my point is, you could have, there just could have been this like whole other trajectory in which like the basic structure of the ideological conflict is still there, but everything is much more like literal. You know, it's like we uncovered this plot. We prevented them from executing like that exact kind of thing in the future. We started doing some changes to the visa system. They start going after softer targets, you know, and it's like blah, 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 blah. Probably we would do something in Afghanistan related to that. Like there was a plan.
We'd probably spend more time on trying to break down the Al-Qaeda cells.
Well, yes, but also like Richard Clark, who had been the like Al-Qaeda coordinator at National Security, something like that. He had like created some plan in the waning days of the Clinton administration that was like, we're going to like put a lot of money into the Northern Alliance and fight the Taliban. And I don't want to like libel anybody with getting this wrong, but I think like the basic call was like, we're like a lame duck now. We're going to just sort of forward this to the next people. And then it landed on the Bush people's desk and it was kind of like,
We have a lot going on.
Yeah. It's like, this is not like our thing.
I mean, it's like, I guess like it's hard because there are tons of things that get like, sorry, we picked up a guy in immigration who like has been flagged by another agency for being connected potentially to other people who are potentially connected to terrorists. It's like,
yeah.
I do want to like say here that civil liberties are important. we believe in them. And like, in order to be the level of intrusiveness you would need is like quite high. Like having traveled to Yemen and Indonesia and like whatever, it's not like illegal or wrong. Like lots of people do this. And obviously, you know, the commission report goes over things that are like way more concerning than just like traveling to Yemen. But I do think that like the fact that some law enforcement agencies were prevented from accessing all the details of certain people's involvement in 9/11 in advance because they had to respect like warrant laws. I don't want to like overread this because I do think that part of the overreaction to 9/11 was that we basically stopped caring about a lot of civil liberties. And it did lead to a bunch of like really horrible actions by the U.S. government that were incredibly counterproductive in addition to being like on the object level bad.
So I think it's important to distinguish, I sort of think, between these tracks, because I think like younger people, particularly younger progressive people, will not understand this the way that I understand it from the time. But, you know, one of the things that happened in the 2000 election was that George W. Bush gained a lot of support from Arab Americans, specifically on civil libertarian grounds, because they felt that Clinton administration counterterrorism proposals had been too anti-privacy, too surveillance heavy and tilting toward racial and ethnic profiling. Because a lot of this, you know, I don't think anything somebody would say from the 9/11 Commission report is just like, well, these guys are Muslims, ha ha ha, right? But it's like, okay, you know, you are from Saudi Arabia and you traveled to Bosnia to fight in the civil war there and you attend like such and such a mosque with like other radicals. And then you went to Malaysia and you were in a meeting like with this other guy who's in a jihad group. And it's like, as you say, like, as far as I know, it's like not illegal to have coffee in Malaysia with a terrorist.
Yeah.
Maybe it's illegal in Malaysia, but you know what I mean? Isn't
it illegal to like consort with terror? I don't know. Is it?
But how would I know? How would you prove that I know?
Yeah.
You know what
true.
I mean?
Yeah.
Like I once had ice cream with a guy in the mafia, but like.
Did you? Is that real?
I wasn't in the mafia. I mean, I honestly don't. Later, somebody told me that, you know, but it's like, I don't know. You know what I mean?
Okay.
So no, again, you can there's a certain level of like common sense around Khalid al-Mihdhar, right? Where it's like, why is this guy traveling to so many global terror hotspots and like meeting with USS Cole bombers?
Yeah.
But like, you could not prove in a court of law that the fact that you had lunch with somebody and that guy is a terrorist means that you're a terrorist.
Because
like, I don't know that much about terrorists, but like they eat lunch, you know, like they're and they are undercover. They are in disguise. They're doing things with false pretenses. Like there's a guy who you could say, like, this is the guy who trained the 9/11 hijackers and how to pilot planes. But that would be a misleading account. Like he was being duped by them. Right. So I think that like one way that if the people who run the Republican Party today had been running the Republican Party on 9/11, the response would have been very, very, very heavily like surveillance, policing, and like total lack of concern about racial profiling.
Well, I want to get into this, but first we should take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
The Argument is brought to you by Forkful. Eating well, I think we all know, can get difficult when life gets busy. Finding time for meal planning can be a challenge. Meal kits promise convenience, but a lot of them actually require a lot of prep and cleanup time. And takeout and processed foods can often sacrifice quality ingredients and tastes. Forkful is about meals that prioritize flavor, function, and health. They give you chef-cooked, fresh, ready-to-eat meals that are made with high-quality premium proteins. And that's stuff like grass-fed bison, wild-caught salmon. They've got all different kinds of delicious menus that can fit your lifestyle and your meal preferences. Whatever you need, eating well does not need to be complicated when you can get fully prepared, deliciously healthy meals with no meal prep, no cooking or cleanup, just clean flavors that are ready in under 3 minutes. I've really enjoyed a couple of my Forkful meals that I've been trying. They have this great sort of barbecued pork with zucchini and mashed plantains. They got a chicken and rice bowl. They got beef barbacoa. They've got a chicken parm. It's a lot of good stuff here on the menu. I've enjoyed what I've had, and I'm excited to dig in more. You should explore our plans and menu of fresh, ready-to-eat meals at ForkfulMeals.com and use code ARGUMENT to get 50% off your first order. That's ForkfulMeals.com/argument. Use promo code ARGUMENT for 50% off. Thanks to Forkful for sponsoring this episode.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, we're back. You know, one thing that I remember from this time, it was considered like a far right take at the time, but Ann Coulter was like a big person for saying, how come we're like making it so much more of a hassle for everybody to go through airport security all the time? Like, we know it's not like white grandmas hijacking planes, right? Like, we know who we need to target these measures against. And I don't want to say, because like I want to be clear, because I know that there are Arab Americans, Muslim Americans whose communities were profiled and who feel that this did not go well for them. But that was not the main thrust of the Bush administration's policy response.
What was not?
To just say, like, we need targeted surveillance and extreme profiling. Like, because like Coulter's point was, you know, there's a trade-off between like liberty and security. But you can evade the trade-off for the majority of people by saying it's going to be all the incidents is going to just fall on Muslims.
Yeah.
Right? And like, they didn't do that. You know,
which is good.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, which is like the correct way to run a liberal society was like they said, like the new airport security rules will apply to everyone.
Yeah.
Now, it may or may not be the case that like, on the implementation level, there was some profiling happening, but certainly the policy was that you are not going to do that. And the stated posture of the Bush administration was to go to a mosque several days after 9/11 and like tell people that Islam is a religion of peace and so on and so forth. And so, you know, and that is just like, I don't want to be heard as like completely whitewashing what happened during this period. I had a student, was an editor of a student paper at the time, and our office was like adjacent in the Kennedy Hall basement to the Harvard Islamic Society. And, you know, it was not like the best year in those guys' lives for very understandable reasons. But the Donald Trump, Stephen Miller version of the Republican Party would have responded to 9/11 by leaning into those impulses. And the George W. Bush version of the Republican Party responded by leaning away from those.
Yeah, and like it's interesting because public opinion moves in like two kind of different directions. There's like one which is like way more hate crimes against Muslims or Muslim, I mean like Sikhs in particular who are misunderstood as Muslims. They have, it's 481 anti-Muslim hate crime incidents recorded in FBI data in 2001, up from 28 the year before. I mean, that's like that's like insanely high levels of like shift. But at the same time, Pew had a poll that shows from March 2001 to November 2001, support favorable views towards Muslims goes from 45% to 59%.
Yes.
And I think that like the Bush effort to separate like these terrorist attackers from Muslims writ large was like reasonably effective. Even though, like, for there's like a core part of the population that obviously react to it in a quite like Islamophobic way, and then also like the implementation of many of the policies, as you said, was not like race neutral. You know what
like, I mean, to really be all man, it's like, you know, you said like in an Islamophobic way,
yeah,
and like in an important extent, because you mentioned right, like favorability of Islam went up.
Yes.
In that Pew survey, right?
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And I think like the concept of Islamophobia is, I don't want to say literally, but like in the mass public is a consequence of 9/11. You know, that I remember a little bit earlier, Susan Mahler Oken, a major philosopher who's passed away, but, you know, was alive at the time and was teaching in the Boston area when I was there, a big feminist philosopher. And, you know, she publishes a book called Is Multiculturalism Bad for Women?
Yeah.
And, you know, this was a controversial take. Her answer is yes. It was a controversial take at the time. But the discourse about Islam on the American left at that time was just similar to the discourse about evangelical Christianity.
Yeah.
You know, it was like negative.
Yeah.
And nobody has ever there's a discourse about Islamophobia as like comparable to racism, to homophobia, right? These are these like bad isms that progressive organizations should have. There's no like evangelical phobia, right? Discourse around that. Like you are just like allowed as a progressive minded person to say that like you think evangelical Christianity is like a bad force that promotes, you know, homophobia, misogyny, like voting for Donald Trump, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not that that's like the only thing people thought about Muslims in 1999,
yeah,
but that was just like a mainstream concept. Like this is a conservative religious tradition that like has a lot of things that we don't approve of. After 9/11, you get hate crimes against Muslims. You get, and again, many of the hate crimes were actually against people who weren't Muslims.
Yeah, like Sikhs.
It's this hazy misidentification of people based on attire, skin color. So it's racialized.
Yeah.
And you get this counter-mobilization, the increase in the Pew poll, where people start saying, no, like we need to combat Islamophobia. Mm-hmm. We need to like tell people about the beauty of the Islamic cultural tradition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's like very much with us, I think, like today in the global left, a like kind of like philo-Islam that is a little hard to understand unless you think about 9/11 overreach, you know, like counter reaction to the counter reaction, right? And eventually reaching the decision that the wars were like an Islamophobic overreach, right? That ended badly for everybody. But I think that at the time, there was seen in the kind of liberal center of American politics, in the neocons and the hawkish Democrats, that this very messianic, utopian, aggressive, warlike foreign policy was a counterpoint, was part and parcel of the same effort to like get people to not do hate crimes against their Muslim neighbors, to say that, you know, like not only does it have to be a military response against the Taliban because of Al-Qaeda and the hard security concerns, but like the Taliban is bad, you know, which I think is pretty unambiguously true.
Yeah.
And that like, as long as we are fighting a war in Afghanistan, which it seems like we have to do, it should be this like really idealistic war.
But I just want to slow down it because I find this like, I still feel like as someone who just like learned this again secondhand, it's kind of insane that we went from we need to go after the people who bombed on 9/11, members of Al-Qaeda, and maybe even go after like the, you know, other outside of
those
the
who harbored
East.
Them.
Yes, people who were with. To now we are going after Saddam Hussein's government. And like part of the slowest down here is like, so Osama bin Laden, the Taliban refuses to turn him over. I think this is actually another contingency. Like if they just get Osama bin Laden like quite early, I think it actually takes away a ton of the like impetus to go further because I mean, they really did. Like he was the focal point. Like this is the evil guy. And they don't get him immediately.
Well, so two things happen. First, the Taliban doesn't hand him over.
Yeah.
And then second, even though the initial military campaign is like quite successful on one level, he gets away at the Battle of Tora Bora, right? So there's like two different turn points.
Yes.
One is like, suppose the Taliban had just been like, well, we fucked up here.
Yeah.
Like, we'll hand him over. Then you maybe get, in Afghanistan at least, to where we are today, which is the Taliban rules Afghanistan, but as far as we know, the Taliban is not sheltering transnational terrorists. The other possibility that's very intriguing to me is like, if we get Osama in 2022, or whenever that was, is that just like, we win and it's over? Because I thought that when it happened under Obama, I was like, all right, like, let's bring the troops home tomorrow.
Yeah.
And there was clearly some sentiment in the Obama administration that they should do that, but they didn't. And so I just don't know.
I think it's worth talking about, like, what Al-Qaeda actually wanted to happen. Because I was actually reading, I have a recent Atlantic issue here, because I was reading this great piece by Graham Wood, Did Al-Qaeda Succeed? And it, like, raises this question about, like, what they want. I think he seems like a little bit open to the fact that there was some of their objectives seem to have worked out for them, namely 9/11, of course, but also he's largely negative on their success. But I mean, I think it's worth like revisiting like what it is that like bin Laden wanted, what they wanted. It's obviously very murky because a lot of what we have are like communiques that were obviously in some part meant to like shape public opinion about whatever.
But yeah, like, we don't. There's not like an Osama bin Laden private diary.
Yeah, like we don't have that. But I mean, so like first he was mad about the ongoing U.S. presence in Saudi Arabia after the Gulf War. So these bases that existed in Saudi Arabia still. He was mad about the U.S. broader support for like what he would call like apostate states in the Middle East, places like Egypt and Jordan, and of course Saudi Arabia. But then he's also wants kind of like a global overthrow of like Western power because he. I mean, this is how Bush put it, but they hate our freedoms, right? Is how he puts it. There's like that aspect of it too. And I think that like there's way more involvement of the US, obviously, in the Middle East now than there was before. And of course, before 9/11, I think we're like still quite involved in the Middle East. The Iran war,
sure.
Involvement with Israel is like ongoing. We have lots of bases still. But I think that like what's interesting about Graham's article is the splinter cells across places like the Sahel, and one thing that one of the people he quotes talks about is that it's very, very difficult to know whether someone is just like beaten or they like are quiet because they're like planning another attack. And like right now, like maybe this episode in like 10 years like ages incredibly weirdly because like we're not paying attention to like obvious terrorist uprisings that are going on that are going to attack the US again soon. And I think it just like really spoke to this fact of like, even though like this is something we have poured, I don't know, like billions, I mean, trillions of dollars in economic activity into like post 9/11 response, we're not like confident about how to like predict whether even this specific cell is going or this specific terrorist network is going to attack us in the immediate term. Like there's like mass division among like these experts that Graham is talking to about whether or not Al-Qaeda is actually like resurgent or like completely beaten.
Well, this is why I think it's a little hard to coherently answer the question of like, did bin Laden succeed? Get what they wanted? Okay. Because bin Laden had a theory, as I understand it, of like the Middle Eastern regime, the apostate regimes, right? He believed that there were all these governments in place in majority Sunni Arab states, and that they were like creatures of the West, right? And that absent like active, constant American support, they would like naturally crumble. And what would rise in their place would be these Islamist regimes that would form a like unified Islamic bloc, mm-hmm. that would do something, you know, wage war against the whatever it is. And like, there's just all these steps on that causal chain. It's just like it's analytically wrong. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like he got like the very specific, like object level grievance about American military bases in Saudi Arabia. Like he did get what he wanted there. That just like didn't cause the Saudi regime to crumble. Mm-hmm. You know, in Syria, it is a long and tangled road and like the causal chain is insane and there's no way he predicted it. But he did, in fact, get the like Alawite dominated Syrian regime to fall and be replaced by a Islamist Sunni regime. It's just that I mean, and literally like an offshoot of Al-Qaeda is running Syria now. Mm-hmm. But even that is not causing like what he wanted to happen. Like they, as part of taking control of Syria, have been trying to make nice, you know, and like tell America like it's cool. They've been like trying to cool down conflict with Israel, and the Israelis are not reciprocating that. But it's like there was just like an inherent unrealism. And it reminds me of.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's how you become a terrorist.
Sure. But yeah. I mean, it reminds me of, you know, there were all these anarchist assassinations in the years before World War One. And a lot of them were successful, like successful in the sense like they killed the guy who they meant to kill. But there kept being this idea that like the propaganda of the deed was going to lead to global revolution. Mm-hmm. And it just like kept not happening. Right. And I don't think that Americans were ever afraid. Well, I'm not sure, actually. Right. So from the U.S. perspective, we could say, OK, our goal here could be to like keep American civilians safe by preventing future terrorist attacks. Mm-hmm. Or our goal could be to like prevent the like emergence of this like global jihad entity. But like, I don't think we needed to do anything to prevent the emergence of the global jihad entity because like it just didn't make sense.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I don't know. Like if you take at some level that like there is, as Graham talks about in his article, like there's like a sense that like bin Laden and the plot on 9/11 was like mastermind plot, mm-hmm. that like these people were like just brilliant like tacticians,
sure.
who figured out a like hole in the American security apparatus in order to like get in there, and that this view I think permeates even amongst a lot of Americans today, that like we were foiled by this like brilliant mind. Now again, it's not super flattering if that's not true, because obviously he conflicted a lot of damage on the United States and like caused us to like get into like entrenched into like a, you know, multi-decade war that cost tons of American lives, not only but also of course Afghan lives and Iraqi lives too. And so it's not like flattering if that's not true, but at the same time, the idea that you would scare people so much into believing that, I don't know, like there's like a, almost like a constructivist like sort of thing. You're like, you would scare them into believing like you are this like great threat to their way of life is like, I don't think it's a super well thought out multi-point strategy to get to like global jihad at the end of it. But I do think there is like a level of success there from a perspective of, we want to freak Americans out into believing that the Middle East not only is like this ascendant like region, and also that their way of life is in direct conflict with ours, and we're going to encourage Muslims worldwide to also view the struggle like this. Like,
right. Yeah. I mean, again, part of what I think is interesting about the response in retrospect is that the Bush administration and the American mainstream, it seemed to me, almost like granted the argument that there was this profound ideological conflict happening in the world. And I mean, beyond that, obviously, the specific decision making around Iraq is very, very important.
Yeah.
But you could have had this without that, right? You could have had the ideological inflation.
Yeah.
And which to me, it's not just that it was wrong, but it was just like really not obvious. Like you could imagine going back into that meeting and being like, guys, like, no. You know what I mean? Like, don't say anything about freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, there's just like this really concrete sort of tactical conflict happening mm-hmm. here where this guy wants to blackmail us into removing our military bases.
Yeah.
And we, A, don't want to remove our military bases. B, don't want to give in to blackmail. And so C, are going to fight back by hardening our security and going after them.
Yeah.
And like, what does he want? He's a fucking nut job.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he like wants this like war against liberal society, but like liberal society is going to survive our military basing decisions. It's going to survive the deaths of people in terrorist attacks. It doesn't matter. Right. But like, no, like they went in on it. Right. And, you know, you look at like the famous, infamous Axis of Evil mm-hmm. speech, which, you know, is written by David Frum, who's become like a great anti-Trump warrior and, mm-hmm. and crusader for the cause of liberalism. And this like Axis of Evil of Iran, Iraq, North Korea, mm-hmm. like he's aware that Iran, Iraq, and North Korea are like unrelated ideological tendencies. And some people will say, oh, Frum was like trying to like muddy the waters there. But I don't think he was exactly. I mean, he was trying to define a global struggle between liberalism and all of its enemies, a struggle that, you know, I think the argument as a publication is like not downstream of that. There's like this like break in the liberal tradition because liberalism becomes like discredited, I think, by this globalizing.
In particular, I think right liberalism. And there's a reason why right liberalism is like so in retreat. And these people are, I mean, when you look at these conflicts between kind of many of more fragments of the new right and
right.
Their constant dunking, not just on the never Trumpers, but like people in their coalition who actually are like just genuine conservatives, but are have like more small L liberal views. Like they are just like, you are the rump of the Democrat, of the Republican Party. You are not, you know, it's over for you. You guys are completely discredited after Iraq. There's such like an anti-interventionist like strain now of the new right, which you could imagine, you know, having been different under different circumstances. But like,
but I
the
think
eradication
not-
of the right, like the fact that most right liberals are now resistance libs at the Dispatch, the Bulwark, et cetera, is like genuinely, I think, downstream of all of this.
Right. And also, I mean, you know, you said that they're anti-interventionist, which I think they're
the right, new right.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a little weird because obviously like, we're witnessing Trump go into Iran.
No. But yeah. I think that that's important because yeah. I think a lot of people on the anti-interventionist left were always like very eager to see in this critique of the neocons.
Yeah.
Like a critique of like intervention. But again, it's like, if you really hate Bush and you hate the neocons, you see this whole thing. It's just like violence and bloodshed and cynicism all along. Mm-hmm. But if you try to engage with them sympathetically, mm-hmm. to think of these people, the exiles from that movement, as like the people who like called balls and strikes on Trump correctly, et cetera, and like take them at their word, that the difference between George W. Bush and Donald Trump isn't that George W. Bush was willing to go to war and Donald Trump wasn't, but that Donald Trump will say things like, we're going to destroy all of Iranian civilization. And George W. Bush would say, like, we're going to bring democracy to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Right. And so the right, the predominant theme in right-wing politics in America, but also in Europe now, is to define politics, global politics, in these civilizational and quasi-racial terms. And the point of the Bush enterprise, like whether it's immigration reform, whether it's compassionate conservatism and faith-based initiatives, or whether it's the war in Iraq, was like to not do that.
Well, it was to do like, it's like to do, there is this global struggle, but it's between like a cosmopolitan, you know, we're all the same across the whole world versus like these forces of illiberalism that are trying to like force it upon us. And that like, if you were able to help like push out these despotic leaders, then the people would rise up, and they're very similar to all of us here who want democracy, who want liberal rights, et cetera.
And I mean, but Bush's second inaugural address, which like I really recommend to, you know, I think it's like a funny thing. There's like a tendency when people like compile like political rhetoric to sort of like focus on the speeches that like held up well.
Mm-hmm.
And like Bush's second inaugural, I think is more interesting because it was such a like last dying gasp of this worldview. But it's this line about how like the fires of freedom like burn in the hearts of men all throughout the world. And we've like set them aloft. And, you know, like nothing like that happened in his second term. And everyone has moved off of that.
But I think what I'll say here is like, I don't want to, I mean, I agree that like a taking them at their word, sympathetic view of the neocon strategy was in a limited sense, an effort to support the forces of what they thought were liberalism, whether it's the fires of democracy that are in the hearts of people across the world or whatever. But it's also like the choice to help people get to liberal democracy by bombing the shit out of their own countries is also, it's not just like strategically wrong and bad, but it's also like, there's a level of dehumanization of the population that you have to get to where you're like, well, we are able to now sacrifice people in your country for a cause that maybe you believe in or not. I mean, I think this happens with Iran too, where it's like, I think there are a lot of Iranian people, especially women, who are like chafe against the strictures of the society they live in, but like helping them get those rights is not the same as like supporting a bombing campaign. And I think there's like a level to this where we might think in, you know, I don't think it's unlikely we would have done this in like a non-brown third world country. Like, it's just like not the case that we would have been like, okay, just like bombing the shit out of like,
I'm not
like, for instance, like, you know, I mean, I'm not gonna, it's obviously not the same thing, but like many of the 9/11 conspirators were like coming out of a Hamburg, Germany cell. They were getting radicalized together in like Hamburg. And it's just like, obviously you're not gonna do anything about that.
Well, yeah, but I think that kind of cuts the other way. Like, this was, you know, there were a lot of, you know, when George W. Bush was president, there was this magazine, The American Conservative, that Pat Buchanan started. And they were kind of like articulating, they called themselves paleo conservatives at the time, although they're closer to what we now call the new right.
Yeah.
And this was a point that they liked to make a lot, that like Bush and the neocons had this view of like jihadism as like an offshoot of this kind of like despotisms and autocracies and so on and so forth. But they would be like, but look at this cell that came out of Hamburg, mm-hmm. right? Like, they were enjoying the freedom and liberty of the West and just exploiting it to kill us because these are just like bad Muslims, you know, who believe in bad things. I'm just putting it out there. Like, these are,
well, yeah, but there are many more Muslims.
but I'm just saying, like, these are the discourses of ages past, right? And like that Hamburg thing, like it was seen the other way. And, you know, in terms of which interventions are welcomed and which aren't. I mean, the other thing about this.
I think what actually, I mean, maybe it's just, I'm sure people said this at the time, but like, it's just like, yeah, like KSM, for instance, attended like a small Baptist college in Murfreesboro, North Carolina, right? Like, a lot of these people who were involved in some way are like Western educated or whatever. And like, I know that you're not saying this, like, obviously one could take this to mean you cannot, you know, there is a cultural or genetic or whatever in something that cannot be rooted out of people, that if you bring them to the West, you cannot assimilate them, like whatever. But like, it's just sort of like the trivial, obvious progressive response is like 99% of people, more than 90% of people are like not terrorists. And that there are many, many people who do terroristic actions, not like, you know, blowing up the towers. But I really do mean this, because like right now, we're like you said, like we're seeing a resurgence of this view, of this like the new right view is like this exact same view. And it's like often much more, there's like these real attempts to make it like empirical and scientific and like point to statistics and trends or whatever. I'm like, there's like fundamental truth, which is like obvious and yet, and so is seen as like banal and stupid, but it's just like correct. Is it like, many, many more people who come to the United States, even from very conservative Muslim countries, even with extremely conservative Muslim views, not only do they assimilate to our views, but they never, ever were considering blowing anything up. And like, so this idea that like now again, like, you know, the Trump administration, the new right, like whatever, they're all interested in this much more essentialist view of Muslims is they view like a has been vindicated by history. But I think it's like only more so clearly incorrect.
No, I don't disagree.
I know you're agreeing with me.
I don't disagree with you about that. I'm just like, I'm trying to like replicate what the debate of the time was.
Yeah.
And I don't think that like appealing, honestly, to the public opinion in the countries where the wars was fought totally resolves some of these distinctions, you know? So like in Iraq today, like most Kurdish people say the American invasion was good.
Yeah.
A majority of people say that it was bad,
yes.
But it's like Sunnis are like really, really down on it because they wound up on the short end of the stick. And then among Shias, it's like opinion is more mixed. It's negative on average because the sort of Iran aligned groups like message against the United States. But there's some pro people there. I just don't think that it's decisive that like if the numerical tipping point went the other way, like if Kurds were a larger share of the population.
I'm not even saying that public opinion. I'm just saying that like
a clear example in Syria,
yeah,
where the Obama administration decided not to intervene. It seems like a majority of Syrians wanted the United States to intervene in that case, and we just didn't want to. And that was a regression to in the 1990s, right? I mean, the big elite discourse in the 1990s was that American military force did a lot of good in Bosnia, but it came too late. It did a lot of good in Kosovo, but it was timely. It could have done good in Rwanda, but it wasn't deployed. And the whole like racial critique was like the other way around, was like, we are willing to like go to war for these white people.
But these are not the same kinds of war.
They're
like,
not.
These are short interventions to prevent a genocide.
They're not the same.
But I'm saying like, I think it's compatible. Like the idea that like you are not going to do a small intervention to prevent a genocide, which to be clear, I still think that like many people who have done much better security research than I, that like a small intervention could have saved like tons of lives in Rwanda. And that's very different than like, we're going to state build in the Middle East.
In retrospect, one can make all these different
distinctions. Yeah.
Distinctions and draw coherence to it. But yeah. I mean, you know, I think it's instructive for people. If you look back at like 90s pop culture, at the movie The Contender, or the movie,
you're always telling me about movies.
Air Force One.
We have to have a Twitch stream where we just watch movies together.
Yeah. But you know, it's just like a common thing to show at those times fictionally was like an idealistic American president who agreed to use American military power more assertively in the world to help other people.
Yeah.
And just like a vibe was that like that would be a good idea, but that like the voters were a little like stingy.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, another movie that came out right after 9/11, I think had a huge impact, was Black Hawk Down,
mm-hmm.
which today I think is canceled for its rather unsensitive depiction of peoples of East Africa. But at the time, what's that?
I don't know this movie.
Yeah,
Black Hawk Down?
Yeah, it's about the Somalia.
Okay.
The Somalia.
Wait, is this like the I'm the Captain Now movie?
No, that's about pirates.
Okay, that's also about Somalian pirates though, right?
In the early 90s, you know, there were U.S. military forces were involved in a UN humanitarian mission in Somalia.
Okay.
And the humanitarian mission was being undermined by some Somali militias.
Okay,
so
not pirates.
No.
Okay.
So the UN like asked the United States, like, can you like intervene more forcefully like against this guy who's disrupting humanitarian supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did, and the operation went a little bit wrong, and several American servicemen a lot of Somalis died.
Yes, yes.
And after that, the Clinton administration was like, we're packing up and leaving.
Yeah.
Right. And the movie comes out, and it comes out like after 9/11. It's not like a political movie, but again, like the implicit thing that the movie is saying is like these American soldiers are actually like incredibly competent and just like really, really good at fighting. And they were incredibly outnumbered and like basically beat these guys, even though they took some losses. And like we could have just stuck it out instead of turning tail and run. Right. Now, the dynamics of that Somalia operation versus Haiti versus Bosnia versus Afghanistan versus Iraq, like actually it's quite different. Yeah. But these things, you know, flatten into like
This is what's so annoying is like everything becomes you're either pro-intervention or anti-intervention. It's never just like there's like a trillion tools in the intervention category.
But I think it's one different it's to say context. Like, should our basic attitude be that this is where I think a lot of like momentum came out of 9/11 was just that like America over the course of the 1990s was too reluctant to commit military force abroad, that we were excessively casualty averse and financially stingy. And after 9/11, naturally and like correctly, you become a little bit less casualty averse and a little bit less financially stingy because it just turns out that like what happens in the world like matters. Yeah. And so like we should do some stuff. Right. And it's tragic that like the stuff that was done, the willingness to incur really substantial financial costs and in order to achieve things abroad was so misdirected.
Yeah.
Because today it's just like inconceivable that you'd be like, this is going to cost $1 trillion American dollars and thousands of Americans will die. And the point is that we're going to help some foreigners. People would just be like, no. Like, we're not going to do that.
Okay, but, like, it wasn't – I understand that, like, there was an undercurrent among many of the neocons that they were trying to help bring democracy to the Middle East. But, like, the goal was still in America's interest. It was, like, the goal of this is because there was a terrorist attack.
I mean, of course. But, yeah. I mean, you look at Ukraine, right? Where, I mean – I don't want to say similarly, it's quite different, but there's a really clear
cut. But we are spending lots of money.
Yeah, but not close to what we spent in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, we now have, I think, like a stronger case for like, we could just spend some money here and it would be useful, but there's a lot of mixed feelings about it.
Yeah, we spent 195 or appropriated roughly 195 billion in total spending. So yeah, much less.
It's a tenth for something that like makes a lot more sense, right? But people are burned out on like the concept of like trying to be helpful abroad. And of course, you know, I eventually got into effective altruism and mosquitoes and vitamin D supplementation. Like if you were willing to spend these kind of resources to help people,
but you
could do things that were actually helpful.
I am very pro the mosquito nets and GiveWell. And, you know, we join Slow Boring in directing donations there. But, you know, we've had this conversation before in this podcast about foreign policy, but I do think that like the fact that it's very, very difficult to systematically understand how and when and in what ways to intervene internationally in order to support democracy is not an like dispositive argument against trying to continue figuring that out. And I do think that like, yes, it would be great if the marginal dollar in the United States government was spent on things like PEPFAR or on mosquito nets or whatever it is. But also like,
PEPFAR is also a legacy of 9/11, right?
Yes, but great point. But I do think that like we've become so excessively cynical about even the concept that the U.S. should be interested in the liberal democratization of the rest of the world, because when that idea comes up, people instinctively remember, rightfully so, that like that idea led to an invasion that cost millions of people's lives in the Middle East. And
wait, millions?
Isn't that what we are at now?
I thought it was hundreds of thousands.
No, but like, there was like a, how many people deaths caused in Middle East wars? No, but this is important because it was, someone did like a real study about it. There was like a Brown University thing. There were 940,000 people killed by direct post-war violence in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Pakistan between 2001 and 2023.
Oh, that's a quite expansive
list
of countries. Okay.
Yeah, and then an estimated 3.6 to 3.8 million people died indirectly in post-9/11 war zones. Not really sure how they're doing that, but brings the death toll to 4.5 to 4.7 million and counting.
Yeah, but that's because they're roping Syria and stuff into it.
Sure.
Okay.
I agree.
Okay.
Anyway, I wanted to justify it and not just
No. I'm fine. I'm fine with that. I mean, but that's like, I guess to the point where I started, it's like the 9/11 dominoes become so.
Yes. It's difficult to say what are you attributing what to.
So large, right? Yeah. That it's like.
This is the original Matt point that actually it had a huge world historic impact.
Yes. Right. I mean, the Syrian civil war is in some sense downstream of 9/11. PEPFAR is in some sense downstream of 9/11. Like,
but I think the broader point I'm trying to make with this is just that, like, I think it's good for people like me who are, in some sense, some of the last liberal interventionists of any kind in American political commentary to, like, have a ton of humility about the fact that, like, these ideas clearly led people to make horrible decisions that none of us stand by. No one stands by, not even the people who fucking made them stand by it. But also at the same time that, like, you actually can't ignore what goes on in other countries and whether or not those places are democratizing or liberalizing if you care about, like, human suffering, human rights, civil rights, anything that, like, people say they care about across the political spectrum, poverty, whatever. And again, the answer can be, okay, yes, that's true. And what we should do is spend a bunch of money on, like, development aid, or we should do a bunch of things, you know what I mean? Like things like PEPFAR, like whatever it is. But, like, right now, that's, like, not what people are doing. I think on the right, clearly, it's like, sure, fuck all these people. We should not even spend what, like, even when, I mean, it's fucking insane. We published something of the argument, we'll put it in the show notes, about the death toll that came as a result of the Doge cuts to USAID. And, like, there were people responding to that were like, even if this is true, I don't care, sure, because, like, why would we spend $1 on a foreigner's life? And, like, again, I don't think that's everyone in the Republican Party, but it clearly is a dominant strain of people on the right. And then on the left, I think there's, like, this anti-interventionism is often, like, kind of inchoate and not super clear what it is that people are saying. Like, obviously there's, like, an anti-war thing, but, like, this kind of implicates, like, do we give a fuck at all if there's going to be a genocide? Like, what would we do? Like, what should we do? What should a left government do if we think there's going to be a Rwanda-like genocide again? And, like, I think there's such a shying away of this question even that we even interact with because there's a fear of repeating these mistakes. And, like, I don't want humility about this, which I think is correct and, like, an accurate way that you should react to, like, facts about the world that are really negative for your, point of view to lead us to, like, never think clearly again about what the role of the United States should be in helping people in other countries.
Well, this is why I think you were trying to convince me a few weeks ago that I should be long liberalism.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking about 9/11 then. Yeah. But, you know, we were getting ready for this anniversary episode. And, like, I think that everybody, there was a piece recently that was like, George W. Bush is like, doing these, like, sympathetic paintings of immigrants and, like, apparently, like, made, like, an ugly painting of Donald Trump.
But why
won't he, like, say anything about what's going on?
He's letting his art speak.
In the world.
A picture is worth a thousand words.
I wonder if everyone who was involved in touting the Iraq War had just, like, gone into the West.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, like, the resistance to Donald Trump.
Wait, do you mean, like, all, I mean, like you point out, like, that's basically everyone in the country?
No, but, like, people at an elite level. You know, people in media, people, and there's some, like, narrow things. Well, like, Joe Biden never would have become vice president under those circumstances. Hillary wouldn't have run in 2008, right? We would have just been, like, Democrats are good, like Obama-type guys, like, mainstream Democrats, but who did not, and it could be somebody like Amy Klobuchar, right? Didn't, like, speak at an anti-war rally in 2003, but she was Attorney General of Hennepin County.
Yeah.
We have no idea what she thought, but she has no public record. She could just say, like, I was against this from the beginning, right? No, you know, and, like, people my age who didn't, like, happen to have a blog in 2002 could, like, keep going, but I'd be gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, the resistance to MAGA would have been a lot weaker in the short term, because you would have no John McCain. You would have no Bill Kristol. You would have no Susan Collins. You know what I mean? It's like the right would like mogify faster. But I also do wonder if we couldn't have sped up the resurgence of liberalism globally eventually, because still to this day, not you, and you will have to carry this torch into the future. It's like, I think like most of the people making the case for traditional liberalism in the United States and Europe against both this kind of post-liberal right, but also this resurgent like youth socialism are like people who were implicated.
But
in
I think what's interesting is like
post-9/11 hubris.
I both see what you're saying, and also like one of the conceits of this episode was that like most people under the age of 35, and then maybe also many people who were alive at your age, don't actually remember what happened or who was involved.
Right.
So like while I see what you're saying, but like I don't know, like I feel like I discovered many things in the course of my research that I like, you know, you hear about the media manufacturing consent for the war. And you're like, oh, yeah, I thought that was like in a general sense, like they were like very pro-war and they were talking about how, you know, they were reprinting the government's sources that there were WMDs that, you know, Saddam Hussein had WMDs or whatever, or had some sort of material that would help them create a bomb or whatever it was.
Yeah. And aluminum like, tubes.
Aluminum tubes.
Yellowcake
exactly.
uranium from Niger.
Exactly. And like, but that's different than like, oh, like many parts of the American elite apparatus, whether it's think tanks, media, politicians, whatever, were actively, I don't want to like ascribe intent or whatever, but like in hindsight, it seems almost blasé, like or extremely very willing to give credence to the idea that Saddam Hussein was involved in al-Qaeda's attacks on 9/11 without thinking about the long-term consequences of it. And like those people are just, they're just still around.
I agree. We got to
But also like nobody knows.
We got to do a different episode sometime that is like just about Iraq. But like the point that I'm trying to make here is that.
But do you get what I'm saying? Like nobody knows about this stuff. Like, I mean, like, sorry, nobody my age remembers this stuff. I don't know. Like, I didn't remember it.
Okay, but
and like I remember I asked around our very young office, and you know, many people had very little recollection of the details of 9/11.
I absolutely agree with. No, but I mean, I think that like in some ways, I think that like ignorance is bliss in these regards, right? And that people who were not present for these debates, were not involved in the overreach. And, you know, we've been thinking about 9/11 ever since like woke one was crazy.
Yeah.
Became like a catchphrase on the left. We're like, I'm like very out of sympathy with like adult human beings who are like, because George Floyd dying on camera was a very emotional experience, I just like threw out all empirical information about law enforcement. And then I come back to this 9/11 thing and I'm kind of like, well, liberal cosmopolitanism one was crazy. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, it was a very emotional time. We had this live video. It was way more than one person died.
Yeah.
And it just kind of like.
And then we killed 4.5 to 4.7 million people.
It seemed like what you wanted to do was like affirm like the value of freedom and human equality expressively in as unequivocal a way as possible. And I would ask people who think I'm an asshole to think about their own reactions in the summer of Floyd and virtue signaling and so on and so forth that was going on there, and like try to understand why there was this impulse among people who are aware that some of these factual claims, the dots to Saddam, blah, 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 to just be like, you know what? Like, let's like stand with freedom. Let's not stand with Pat Buchanan and like maybe Hitler wasn't so bad and like they're not fit for democracy in Afghanistan and stuff like that.
But Democrat is president when 9/11 happens. What do you think occurs? Do you think we still go to war and have all this?
No, I mean, if a Democrat was president when 9/11 happens, I think.
It becomes like all their fault. It's well, like completely, it's an intelligence failure.
There's appropriately more focus on the specific intelligence and law enforcement failures. I think that there is immediate, you know, short term, Republicans are all like, yeah, like war in Afghanistan, like we've got to do it. But as soon as that starts hitting roadblocks, right wing isolationism, I think you get to MAGA faster. In that scenario, like, I think you don't have quite the same level of overreach, but you get to the backlash to the overreach faster because it would just seem really obvious.
But then Obama gets to, like, defeat them all in 2008 still.
Well, maybe, yes. And you know, I mean, you know, so, like, I guess the story I usually tell is, like, Al Gore is president for one term. And then 2004, you get a bigger Nader campaign than ever before from people who are just anti-war. And you get, like, a Republican come in. And then
you think, like, a MAGA Republican?
Well,
like, in anachronistically. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, somebody just being, like, you know what we got to do is just like border security and surveillance of Muslims domestically instead of all these wars. But then it like goes to shit with the financial crisis. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe Donald Trump gets elected as a Democrat.
In 2008?
Yeah. Because he's against NAFTA and, you know.
Yeah. Well, now we've gone to
who knows? I mean, that's
alternative
just,
history.
That's just like, you know, silly season. But like, I think that we need to, you know, reconstitute from first principles, like, what does liberalism mean for international affairs? Because I think it's important because Obama came in with this like good war, bad war dichotomy, mm-hmm. Iraq, Afghanistan, that had a lot of like moral logic to
it. Afghanistan was a good war.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. Go on.
It had a lot of moral logic to it and political logic, and like people voted for it. And I think everyone was like, yeah, that makes sense. Right. Like the war that we had like a valid basis for, mm-hmm. we should do that one.
Yeah.
And the war that was like hysteria and lies, like that was bad. And it is inconvenient that I think like on a practical level, the Iraq war has turned out better than the Afghanistan war, right? Like, it doesn't mean it was a better war, but it's just like the universe doesn't fit the tidy moral logic of like we had a reasonable cause in Afghanistan and Iraq was like fake and made up. I don't know. I'm not nearly knowledgeable enough to like explain why like post-war consolidation has in fact gone better in Iraq than Afghanistan. But I think it clearly had like daily life in Iraq is better than daily life in Afghanistan. We're closer to having achieved our objectives there. Somewhere in the Dick Cheney archives, he's like saying that about Iraq, that like Afghanistan, like it's not really much we can do there. But like Iraq, I think has potential. And of course, that's crazy to just like invade the wrong country because you think it's more convenient. But like, we don't know. Like where we and like Samantha Power, right? Like Problem from Hell, again, like Iraq War Hawk. And she winds up running USAID under Biden. I think like does a good job with it and like institutes some useful reforms. And like, you know, it's not perfect, but like was in fact like a meeting the like reasonable criticisms mm-hmm. of the agency in many ways. And then it all goes to shit. But we don't have like a good like theoretical account of like what are we doing?
The through line of this entire conversation is that when an emergency happens, it is very, very easy for even extremely good epistemic communities to default to yes manning their own ideological priors, no matter whether the logic actually ends up where you want it to, whether you feel like you're affirming false things about the world. But it also is like very depressing because to me, it's more just like, this is human nature and I don't think this is solvable.
Well, part of what's challenging about foreign policy, right, is
there's no RCTs in foreign policy.
But also that's like a large terrorist attack happens and the organization that orchestrated it is based in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So clearly something to do with Afghanistan should happen. But like, nobody who matters in American politics.
Well, to be clear, we did destroy most of Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. No. But I just mean, like, I remember, again, I was in college.
Like, in the immediate aftermath, like, Bin Laden and all of his, like, deputies, while they're, like, promoting this idea that, like...
They're promoting this idea that
actually, we're going to get the U.S. entrenched in this long war and whatever. That's the real, like, 5D chess move. They're, like, complaining behind the scenes about, like, all of their stuff getting disrupted, the money going away, like, if their friends are dying, like, whatever. So, like, I mean...
Wait. No. I just mean that, like, as the political system tries to, like, reconstitute itself.
Yeah.
I'm like, there on campus. And the Kennedy School is like, we should, like, throw together a panel discussion, you know, about this. But it's like, they don't, like, have on hand anyone who's, like, an expert in contemporary Afghanistan.
Yeah.
You know, like, they don't have anyone who, like, speaks Pashto.
Yeah.
And that's a university. And, you know, like, nobody in the American Senate, nobody in the New York Times editorial board, like, none of them know anything about Afghanistan. But it's like, we've got to do takes about Afghanistan, right? Like,
so now there's a media criticism thing.
No, but it's also the political system, right? Yeah. It's like, because it's correct that, like, the American government has to do something.
Yeah.
And the something has to have something to do with Afghanistan. But it's just, like, not... like, well understood by the relevant decision makers. They don't have access, you know, and, like, maybe, like, everybody should have quit their jobs and been replaced by subject matter experts, but that's not how the world works. It's just like a difficulty of international affairs, right? Like, economic policy is so reliably in the news and, like, happening in Congress that you can expect a responsible United States. They don't all have, like, well-informed people to, like, help them think through economic policy, but they should.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's always coming up.
Yeah.
And, like, but, like, foreign stuff is so, it's so important.
Well, I don't know. I actually think, I mean, like, analogizing this, like, even the economic stuff, like, when new novel economic problem is hit, like, what do you do when the entire world shuts down because of a global pandemic? I mean, it's not, like, entirely novel, but... people had, like, pretty weird, insane takes in hindsight about what was going to happen in the economy. And I think the real problem with foreign policy is both the lack of subject matter experts that are sufficiently high up in elite apparatuses, the demand, like you said, to do something related to whatever the emergency was. But it was just, like, foreign policy, unlike almost every other policy area, is, like, first of all, it's not one thing. There's foreign economic policy. There's foreign, like, all the things that exist, like, foreign education policy. Like, it's the same, like, there's all those different levels of policies. But what is domestic policy? You know what I mean? Whatever. But also just, like, I mean, I said this jokingly, but, like, there are no RCTs in foreign policy.
Yep.
Like, it's almost like no view ever gets discredited in foreign policy because there's, like, everyone is arguing from example. Everyone is arguing from, like, counterfactuals that they can, like, draw up that would have happened differently if their person's been charged. And, like, you, like, I don't know, you're, like, in introductory IR classes all around the country, and it's just sort of like, yeah, these are the three schools of thought, and they're entirely based on vibes. Like, it's entirely based on, like, four or five ideas. And, like, again, even for people who are, like, extreme subject matter experts, it's like, what do you do when you want to prevent a genocide is, like, not even close to a solved problem.
Yeah.
What do you want to do when, like, inflation's high? Like, it's, like, difficult to do politically, but, like, it's a solved problem. You know what I mean? And so...
Well, this has already been, I think, the longest episode we ever recorded.
I don't know, can't really get
into inflation.
We can get into inflation. No, we should. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to do peer review. The Argument is brought to you by Dash Dog Food. Today, I want to talk about something every dog parent deals with, deciding what actually goes into our dog's bowl. I have two dogs, Charlie and Laika, and they eat stuff off the floor, but I still care what goes into their bowl. Most of us want to feed fresh food, so I've been looking into Dash Dog Food. It was created by ButcherBox co-founder Bobby Quirk after he adopted his dog Maisie. He had 10 years of experience sourcing humanely raised meats and noticed that the fresh dog food market relied on vague ingredient origins and harsh cooking methods that strip essential nutrients. So he created Dash to raise the standard. They use 100% grass-fed beef and organic chicken, no antibiotics ever, and no added hormones. Instead of high heat processing, every recipe is sous vide cooked at 165 degrees Fahrenheit to preserve the natural nutrition. And it's packed with clinically backed pre- and postbiotics for healthy digestion. If you're looking for high-quality, fully transparent fresh food for your dog, check out Dash Dog Food. Your dog will thank you. Get 60% off a trial box of premium nutrition slow-cooked fresh dog food with code ARGUMENT at dashdogfood.com. That's dashdogfood.com, code ARGUMENT.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Welcome to Peer Review. This is a segment of the podcast every week where we go over a new white paper that's, or new to us white paper, that we found interesting. This week we have Kumon Up, Private Tutoring Centers and Student Achievement by Joshua Goodman and Samuel Nitkin. This is basically a paper that documents both like the large spread of places like Kumon and tutoring centers across the United States, and finds that not only do they, unfortunately for any teens out there, they do have a pretty big impact on student achievement, but the impact is like very differential. So they look at places in the country where you have centers really popping up, and they find that student achievement really increases for white and Asian students, primarily Asian students, but you don't see the same for the rest of students. And this largely seems to be about adoption, that like most people who are using Kumon, it's mostly about income levels, and that higher income people, as we know, have fewer, are less likely to be Black or Hispanic. But that's not the only thing. I mean, I think around 4 to 6% of Black, white, Hispanic, high income households in these areas are using some form of tutoring or test prep outside of school, but like 9% of Asian households are. So like clearly there's also like a different angle going on there.
This is one of these papers where it, you know, I think if you exist in the world, especially if you're a parent, it's not like earth-shattering knowledge to learn that like private supplemental instruction helps kids, mm-hmm. and that it is primarily done by more affluent parents, and also that Asian families are at any given level just like more jazzed up about this than non-Asian families. But you know, I think the like policy upshot, which is like outside the four walls of these research findings, is just to remind people how like actually inequitable it is when you dumb down public schools in the name of equity. Mm-hmm. You know, because like this is something that we've seen in a lot of school systems. This idea that like if advanced coursework is disproportionately being used by white and Asian families, it like shouldn't exist or it should go away. But it's the people with the most resources and the most commitment aren't like, what can I do? You know, it's like you get a private tutor, you get these chain things and with Zoom, right? I mean, they are able to instrument on like, did the private tutoring center open? But like in the emerging technological paradigm, it'll be much less bounded by that kind of thing. And so it's like, you can give people in the public education system like good math instruction, and then we'll see what happens. Or you can like not give it. And like, we know what happens, which so like, is like people able / motivated. It's both and able.
It's pretty small numbers of people relative, like, you know, 4%. You know what I mean? It's very small.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think what I will say is like the thing that shocked me about this paper is that their estimated center entry effects explain nearly 2/3 of districts' improvement in math scores from 2009 to 2019, which that means like from over a decade period, mm-hmm. 66% of the improvement in math scores is due to the fact that a private tutoring center opened up in the district. Mm-hmm. And like, it's about, the effect costs are $75 per district pupil, mm-hmm. which is like way less than we would spend, yes. to increase math scores through the public system. I will say this, like, I think a lot of people are taking this paper to like, I mean, I've seen this some commentary about this, and some of it is saying, well, we should just, instead of, you know, plowing even more money to the public school system, we should just pay for people to get this math instruction to go to Kumon or whatever it is. I think there's like some, I mean, I think it'd be good to have like, you know, here, we'll pay for people to get math instruction from, you know, private tutoring or whatever. That seems like a fine policy idea to me. But I do think this, like, this paper speaks to only high income students will, yes. increase their math scores if they get private tutoring. It doesn't necessarily tell us what would happen for what are potentially lower performing students if this would have the same level of impact. Like, it is easier in some senses to get someone from being like an 8 out of 10 math student to a 9 out of 10 math student than, let's just say similar, 6 to 7 out,
sure.
of 10 than it is to like get someone who like missed a bunch of foundational stuff because they have a bunch of shit going on at home, and now all of a sudden they need to get to like 8th grade level readiness. Like, that's like it's an incredibly difficult problem because you have to catch someone up on like 8 years of coursework that they just like haven't done.
Yeah. On the other hand,
yeah,
like I could teach somebody multiplication tables,
yeah,
but I couldn't teach somebody calculus. And, you know, that's a funnel and instructional
yeah.
capacity
yeah.
that's going to exist out in the world. So,
but it's like my point is like, I don't know from this paper, like, I mean, we know that they're doing math.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're doing like what kind of math they're doing.
No, no, I agree. But look, I mean, it's a reminder though that like, you know, the structure of conventional public schools is just like really not like optimizing to teach people
yeah.
stuff. Now, some of that is like for good reason.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like things shouldn't just all be like maximizing everything all the time. But like some of it is for, I think bad reasons. And there is just like a lack of focus on like trying to do cost-effective instruction. And, you know, like that's bad. It's sobering that these private companies are able to deliver this at so much lower cost. I'd recommend the Arguments article about public sector labor unions, you know, because you can also just see that between public school systems, mm-hmm. that the like cost basis structure of different public school systems in America is like all over the map. And it holds. There is evidence that like marginal funding increases lead to better educational outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just like also evidence that like cross-sectionally, like the spending levels are uncorrelated with outcomes, right?
Yes.
And those are like a little bit hard to reconcile.
Yeah.
But it's you.
But it's also like just repeating myself, but it's just like, education is not one problem. Like the problem of educating like a bright young child from like a healthy, rich family to be good at Calc 2 and ready to go to college, ready to take higher level mathematics is like a different problem than like, how do you take an eighth grader who like never learned his times tables and like get him ready to take a standard? Like, it's just like,
yes, I mean,
a different problem.
That is definitely true. But I just mean that I think we see over and over and over again throughout the educational system that there are just like big fundamental, like, cost structure issues
yes. yeah.
that are not like rationalizable, you know, that if you somehow just like zero baselined everything
yeah.
and like rebuilt from scratch, like it seems like things could be done much, much, much better. One thing that you cannot quite get at with the way this is instrumented that is always tricky in education is like, what is the instruction versus what is like the motivation that is tokened by the instruction?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
no.
So
what do you mean?
The center opens
mm-hmm.
and like some people go.
Yeah.
And like others don't go.
Yeah.
And part of what's happening is like the people who signed up are signing
yeah.
up for to, but I mean, it's not just they're different, it's
yeah.
selected, but it's like they are investing their own effort in
yes.
the situation.
Yes.
And like, is there a world in which they just like buy some book that's like,
well,
even
this,
cheaper?
Actually,
you know?
There's a historical analogy for you. Did you know, I learned this while researching for this podcast, in 1980, from 1980 to 1989, roughly, South Korea just banned private tutoring. Did you know about this?
No.
Okay. I forget what it's called. The Chun Doo-hwan government in July 1980 imposed an extraordinarily broad ban on like mm-hmm. private extracurricular tutoring, including private lessons, the Hagwons, or these private cram tutoring academies for entrance exams. Like, they banned them. And the rationale is largely about like financial, economic playing field
mm-hmm.
type stuff.
Sure.
One study that I found that like you're basically substituting hours spent in by yourself studying for these, like,
right.
people like they didn't like play more. They just like studied by themselves and like did some like study groups or whatever. There also was an illicit like risk premium private tutoring, like, you know, illegal mafia, I guess, or whatever that was trying to provide this sort of thing at higher cost for families that wanted to risk the law. The impact of this is really interesting. So there's like one paper that looks at the 1989 legalization as a natural experiment, and they find that admission to elite universities rises disproportionately in wealthy areas as a result. Mm-hmm. So clearly there was, I don't want to draw, a lot's going on in South Korea in the 1980s or whatever, but like it is likely the case that there was like some sort of leveling effect in terms of inequality of like where people come from who went to the top university. But like also at the same time, like, again, they're very, very careful about drawing like too hard of a causal explanation from this. It does seem like school scores might have been like slightly lower in the years where you weren't allowed to do private tutoring, which seems like. That's like super interesting. I don't know. They liked it. And also, I think it cuts against a lot of people's intuitions around, you know, Asian Americans and Asians and private tutoring.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when I was in college, I took the LSAT because there's no money in journalism and no future in it. And, you know, I did a practice test and I got like an okay score. And I was like, I better do better on this. And so I got some LSAT books and I like did it by myself. And
did you get better?
I got way better.
What was your score?
What's that?
What's your score? You're going to share it?
It's 179.
Well, what was the first score?
So then I took it. I don't remember. But I did way better. And then I came to D.C. and because there's no money in journalism.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the fuck am I going to do?
Yeah.
And so I did some LSAT prep because I had a really, you don't have to have gone to law school. You just need to.
Wait, you did LSAT prep after you already got 179?
No, I taught it for money.
Oh, you taught it. Okay, sorry.
So, you know, so I like to say, like, I'm better than a lawyer because I was an LSAT prep teacher. And, you know, because all you need to qualify to be an LSAT prep teacher is a good LSAT score.
Yeah.
My kids, they did better after they took my class. But I swear to God, all I did was be like, take the fucking practice test. You know what I mean?
And but that's so real. I mean, this is happening with AI tutoring now, too. I have a friend of mine who's
So it's like, because I think people like read this stuff both ways, right? And the more like progressive take is like, oh, this like private tutoring, like it does so much. And then the more like conservative, like pull yourself up by your bootstraps take is like, you can literally just get these practice
books.
But
that is do so much.
For like, free at
the
library.
I think it's very, very hard to like make yourself study.
I absolutely agree. Yeah. I mean, it's just that like, I think like the tutoring works.
Yeah.
But like the main thing that works about it.
Is it makes you practice.
Is just you're like, you know, and it's like the same thing. It's like people take exercise, you know, have trainers and it's like, sure, yes, they give you some instruction and stuff, but like the main thing is they make you do it.
Yes.
Right? Because people tend to be a little bit lazy. And so I don't know.
I've
never been
in
a Kuban. My son doesn't do that.
Yeah. He does tutors though, right?
Math. Yeah. But it's like getting, you know, like motivation is hard. Motivation is a scarce resource in contemporary society. And just like things that get people to do the work, even when it's not like so galaxy brain, right?
Yeah, I was not a studier.
You could just do the prep stuff at home by yourself for free.
But what I will say about the South Korea thing is that it was super popular. So like they tested parents and it was 75% wanted the ban to continue. The general public, 68% wanted it. Students, it was 61%. And it was teachers, 56%. So the least it was still popular among teachers, clearly. But like, I mean, it kind of makes sense where you're kind of like, individually, a parent might be like, I kind of want it so my kid doesn't fall behind. But they're like, if nobody did it, then the playing field's level. I don't have to. And it's like.
Positional competition.
But it is. But it's also like, I think it's very hard to explain the benefits of you really do want this really smart kid to be even like slightly smarter. Like like it helps you if he goes on to like.
You don't believe in like externalities, innovation, growth, progress?
I'm saying it's hard to explain that to people.
Oh.
It's hard to like internalize that if you don't already. I mean, because it's not as clear as like, hey, like studying culture is like really bad and like kids are like killing themselves over it or like they're like, you know, it's ruining childhoods or whatever. Like it feels very concrete to a lot of people. But like maybe one of these kids will go on to be an engineer that will be part of a team that helps solve some electric car company problem. I mean, just sort of like,
I just think about like the smartest people I knew, you know, like, when I was younger, and like one of them, he's like, he's working away at NVIDIA building like better chips to accelerate Doom.
Yes, but like the problem
another
is like, we're
in
not
private equity, a heroic capital allocator, making sure that our investments are maximized. It's great.
Yeah, two very similar jobs. Well, that, I think that's peer review.
Yeah. If you want to get ahead in a, you know, zero sum positional competition against your friends, you need to, you need to like this podcast. You need to subscribe.
Yes.
You need to share.
Tell your
friends. You need to comment. All forms of engagement are valuable. Spread the good word.
Every month we do a book club. This month we're going to be reading The Road to Serfdom by Hayek. And leave a comment below if you have any questions or comments that you want us to address. Thanks. See you next week.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.